G'day team, welcome to the U Project. Craig Anthony Harper reporting in for duty as I do. 0830 here in the thriving metropolis of Melbourne for episode number 500 and something. What number are we up to, Tiffany Ann Cook?
521 went up today, I think, I believe. Well, I mean, it happens so fast, so I lose count.
And when are we putting up the good prof? Tomorrow or in a few days?
That's a great question. I feel like you might be that excited that no matter what the schedule is, you might just ring me after this episode and go, get that up tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what I often do. When we have a great guest. Well, we have a lot of great guests, but I did a little bit of a deep dive on Professor Feldman Barrett last night, watched a video, read some stuff. And, you know, remember when we had, what was his name, Dr. Amit Goswami, who's that 84-year-old professor of theoretical quantum physics, and you find yourself in the middle of a conversation that you're not smart enough to be in? I feel that could be the case today. So Professor Feldman Barrett, do I call you Lisa? Do I call you Prof? Do I call you Doc? Do I call you, what do I call you?
What do you call your other guests? I mean, I answer to Empress, Your Highness, but I'm also, I'm good with Lisa. If you go by first names, that's fine.
All right. Well, I'm gonna probably swing in and out. Thank you for joining us on the U Project. Now, you're a straight up smarty pants. And so I'm a little bit intimidated. So tread lightly with me, because reading your bio is, it's ridiculous, but, congratulations on all your work. Congratulations on your research. You're a bit controversial. I read an article. Now, I'm a little bit sweary and I get in trouble for that, but Australians are a little bit sweary. You probably know that. But I also heard you say fuck in an interview. So I couldn't be prouder.
I am a potty mouth. It's true. You know, and I'll say, you know, scientists really don't like the F word, fact. Fact is a scary word for a scientist, but you know, other F words are perfectly acceptable. So I do appreciate a good swear word now and then.
Well, I think it makes you, I mean, not that, you know, I actually got an email yesterday from somebody telling me how disappointed they were in me. I went, well, clearly you haven't followed me for long, because I've written 9 books and my best-selling books got fuck on the front cover. So relax. But, you know, I think sometimes it's user friendly, and it's not just about the swearing, but it's about being relatable and real and authentic. And one of the challenges I think sometimes for academics is, my opinion only, is that they feel like they're always being evaluated and judged by their peers. And so they're very, very particular about what they say and don't say. But on a podcast, you're not talking for the most part to an academic audience per se. You're talking to the general public. And we have about 10,000 listeners a day on this show. And it's a real broad, eclectic mix of everyone from professors to, you know, kids and students and mums and dads and builders and bloody kickboxes, and it's a very broad mix. So I think it makes you relatable. So Thanks. Now we know this, but where do we find you today?
Well, today I'm coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts, which is where I live with my family. And I work at Northeastern University. That's where I'm a professor, which is in downtown Boston. And I also have, part of my lab is at Massachusetts General Hospital, where I also have a research appointment, and at Harvard Medical School.
Now, we ask all of our international guests, which is about every second one at the moment, what's the COVID? Just give us the 1 minute on the COVID experience and snapshot for you. Are you okay? Is it mayhem? Is it like where you are right now? What's the status?
Massachusetts is the state that I live in, and Newton is the town that I live in, which is butts up right against Boston. And it's pretty calm here. It's a very high vaccination rate here. Everyone's pretty much responsive, wearing, you know, when we had to wear masks. I think now where the Center for Disease Control in the United States is recommending now that people go back to masking indoors. And people are pretty calm about it here. There's not a lot of controversy, but you have to understand that Boston has, I don't know how many universities and colleges in its vicinity, lots and lots and lots. So there's a real, you know, like science is alive and well here in the Boston area, just because there are so many, you know, not just universities, but tech companies and things like that. So it's pretty calm here. How is it with you?
It's where we are in Victoria. So we spoke before, Melbourne, you know, bottom of mainland Australia, below us, Tasmania, of course, but it's, we're not bad. You know, somebody sneezes in Australia and that state goes into lockdown, like almost hyper-vigilant. But in Victoria right now, where we are 7 million people, I don't know, Tiff, what? There's like 10 or 20 cases, not many at all. Very few people are dying. Of course, one death is too many. But it's because I think we're an island, we've fared pretty well. And I think the government, for the most part, as unpopular as they may be, but I think that's always going to be the case. I think they've done really well. Above us is a state called New South Wales, and above that, Queensland. And they've been relatively untouched, but in the last month or two, they've had outbreaks. So now New South Wales has been in lockdown by lockdown, I mean can only leave the home for four reasons. You know, like medical, food, 1 hour of exercise a day. And it's been a culture shock. So, I think, you know, we're very fortunate over here that we're not in the middle of a whole bunch of other countries and people coming in and out. So, you know, being able to come in and out of Australia pretty much is non-existent at the moment.
I was actually in New Zealand right before the COVID became an official pandemic, and we actually had to leave early. We decided to leave early to head home. And I think I got home 24 hours before
the shit hit the fan.
Yeah, we decided to close the labs in advance of the university mandates to do that, but only by a couple of days. And then it was really locked down for months and months and months. But where we are in the United States, there's not a lot of controversy, you know. But when I was in New Zealand, we were on the South Island and there was no cases there. And I think on the North Island, there were four and they were all localized to Auckland. But it was actually a flight to Auckland. It was on a flight to Auckland that I heard some other information that made me in the air change our itinerary. And we just continued on to San Francisco to make it home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was very dramatic. Yeah.
Well, you could have spent 6 months in New Zealand if you didn't get out when you did.
Exactly. That wouldn't have been so bad, though, honestly.
Yeah, if you're going to be stuck anywhere in the world.
Or and they have amazing peanut butter, seriously. Like, I don't understand how it
really?
Is that. But oh my God, it's amazing.
Dude, peanuts are peanuts, aren't they? What are you talking about?
No, not at all. I don't know why, don't ask me, but actually peanuts from like Virginia and North Carolina in the United States are so much better than anything else that you can get in the US. But there's a brand of, there are two brands actually of New Zealand peanut butter that are just to die for, seriously. Right. Yeah.
Well, what are they? Do you know?
One is, Hicks. I think that's the one that we eat. And then there's another one that I tried while I was there, which was also, but I can't remember its name. Sorry.
Well, shout out to Hicks Peanut Butter. Feel free to send both myself and the good prof a carton of your finest. I'll chuck one in for Tiff as well. She looks hungry over there at the U Project Central. All right. Enough about COVID and peanut butter. And so when you were growing up, Doc, what did you want to be? When you're a kid, you're thinking, I want to be an astronaut, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a researcher, I want to be a bricklayer. What is it that you wanted to be when you were a kid?
I think I wanted to be a doctor.
Medical doctor.
Medical doctor, yeah.
And what happened to that? How did that get derailed?
Well, I went to university and I was dating a medical student, and many of my friends were medical students. And I just looked at their life, and I looked at what they had to do, and it wasn't the amount of work that frightened me. It was just that I really don't like being bossed around. I don't like being told what to do. I can't even follow a recipe, frankly. And so in medical school, you basically have to learn a bunch of stuff that other people have discovered. And I don't want to be disrespectful, but you know, it's like very, very, very fancy mechanic. And I didn't know that there were MD PhDs. So I didn't know that you could also do research as a physician. I thought physicians just practiced the practice of medicine. So early on, you know, I started working in a professor's lab, and I discovered that I really loved research. And I also, you know, discovered that if I don't sleep for 36 or 48 hours, you don't want to be around me. So the kind of lack of sleep thing, and also the bossing around thing, and the kind of rote memory thing just really soured me on the whole path. I just decided that I really liked research better, and I really liked the freedom of it, or what I thought was the freedom of it. And I like the thrill of discovery, you know.
I think the difference with, or one which you pointed out obviously, is that when you're in research, you're opening new doors, you're creating, you're exploring, you're solving problems, you're investigating, you're turning over stones, rocks, and you're figuring stuff out, and you can to an extent pioneer if that's how your mind works and that's how your energy is. And I think, you know, we're similar in that I figured out when I was about 22 or no, probably 18, 19, 20, I wasn't lazy, but I didn't like having a boss or a job. So I set up my first company at 26, and that was 31 years ago. You and I were born in the same year, 63, and bloody oath, we look good, don't we?
I was just going to say that. We do. We don't look like.
I tell you what, we don't want to brag. You listeners can't see us, but fucking hell, we look amazing. Hey, Tiff, can we put this up as a video as well? Because, we're stunning. All right. So, but I figured that out too, Doc. You know, and that was 31 years ago, and just being able to create stuff and make decisions and try things that work and things that don't work and learn and fuck up and get up and keep opening doors and keep asking questions. I think again, different things work for different people. And as you said, there's no disrespect to doctors. They're brilliant and amazing. We need them. But I think for me, coming into a traditional model of clocking in at 9 and clocking off at 5 and being a cog in a corporate machine, would have done my head in by the time I was 30.
I agree. I also think that, you know, if you're a really good physician or clinician of any sort, you know, you're a consumer of science, and that's great. I mean, I really wanted to be a producer of science, meaning I wanted to experience the thrill of discovery. And of course, what comes along with that is the tragedy of defeat. You know, sometimes you're wrong and you have to sort of accept that you're wrong about things, and you have to do it consciously and treat it as an opportunity to learn more. So I have never really regretted the decision to not go to medical school. For me, I think it was exactly the right path. But I will say that, you know, my path to where I am right now is really twisty. I mean, I retrained in a bunch of different fields, and I don't know very many people who start off, you know, knowing what they want to do and actually stick to that path for their whole lives. I think particularly now, when people are living longer on average in most urban centers, people live longer than they would before on average. And so, you know, people often have longer, kind of more interesting paths because they have time for that.
That's right. I think some people fit very well into the, you know, I've got a job and security and I have this many holidays a year and work cover and sick pay and all of that very formulaic and predictable stuff, which is good because they like that predictability and certainty and structure and consistency. Nothing wrong with that. But again, that would do my head in. But I don't know how many jobs or versions of jobs, probably not jobs, but roles that I've played. Like I started off in you know, working in gyms when I was a kid and went and did exercise science. And so just worked with elite athletes and teams and owned gyms. And, but by the time I was 30, maybe even younger, I realized I'm actually more in the psychology and emotion space than the physiology, because I'm constantly talking to anatomy and physiology and biomechanics and nutrition, and all of those things are interesting, but it's all the other stuff that drives those behaviors to execute those things to produce those results. And so you end up where I ended up, where I'm working with humans who have a body rather than working with bodies, you know? And so that's why talking to people like you fascinates me. Like I read in one of your articles that, or I read in an article about you that, I think, was it as an undergrad student, you tried to replicate some study and some result and you failed 8 times.
That was graduate student.
Could you give us the snapshot of that and what you learned? You actually didn't get it wrong. You got it right, but you discovered something new.
Yeah. So when I went to graduate school, usually what happens is your supervisor, your advisor, research advisor gives you a study to replicate, you know, to cut your teeth on so that you can practice. And then from there you build your own research program. And so there was a line of research that the main hypothesis was that you have these beliefs about yourself, about what you're actually like, and you have standards or desires for what you ideally would be like to be like, you know, what your ideal self would be. And then there are standards that other people hold for you that you think you ought to match. And so when there's a mismatch between your ideal self and your beliefs about your actual self, you'll feel sad and maybe even depressed. And when there is an inconsistency between who you think you ought to be, that other, you know, your belief that what other people think, standards that you should meet, and your idea and your actual self, that you would feel anxious or fearful. And so, you know, there were a number of studies that showed this pattern. And so I tried 8 times to replicate studies, and couldn't do it ever. Actually, 8 times. And so at the end of 3 years, I was thinking, I was a mess, actually, a real hot mess, because I was thinking, you know, I can't be a scientist. And I was in the middle of getting divorced from my medical intern husband, and my practice husband, as I like to refer to him. And I was writing comprehensive exams, which at the time, this is something that happens in graduate school, where for 6 weeks, you're basically, you don't sleep and you're tortured and you have to show everything that you know, and they can just fail you and then you have to go away, you know? So it's a really horrible time. And I just thought, well, at least I'm training to be a therapist and maybe I can earn a living that way. And, but you know, I went back and I looked at my data, and what I discovered was that the reason why I wasn't replicating prior findings is that when people report feeling sad or having depressed mood, they also report feeling anxious. And when they report feeling anxious, they also report feeling sad. So what people were really reporting was, I feel great, or I feel like shit. They weren't really telling you much more than that with these measures. And so I replicated this 8 times, you know, because that's what was happening. Every study, I couldn't find this differential pattern, because the outcome measures, feeling sad or depressed and anxious, were so highly correlated. People were just telling you, I feel bad, I feel crappy. That's all they were telling you with these scales. So I thought this was interesting, because anxiety disorders and depression are supposed to be very, very different disorders with very, very different symptom profiles. But guess what? They're not, actually. Yeah. And in fact, the comorbidity, meaning the people who hold both diagnoses, is something like 70% of people for certain anxiety disorders. So I thought this was pretty interesting. And my really naive view at the time was, well, maybe the problem is that I'm just asking people how they feel. So if I could figure out a way to measure their emotional state without asking them, like my looking at their facial expressions or by measuring their physiology, their body or something, then I'd be golden, right? Because then I could know what their emotional state was. And then I could, because I'd have these objective measures of their emotional state. And then I could compare that to their beliefs about the self. And I thought, well, you know, this isn't going to take very long. Maybe it'll take a couple of months and I'll just figure out what these objective measures are. And then I'll just get back to my research. And, you know, here we are 30 years later. I mean, there are no objective indices of any emotional state because emotions don't work like that. And for me, the real puzzle was, so there are no objective markers in the brain or the face or the body. I'm not saying it's all random, but for example, when people are angry, research shows they scowl about 30% of the time.
Wow.
That's more than chance, you know, but people scowl. Well, first of all, that means 70% of the time people are doing something else with their face when they're angry. That's very meaningful. That isn't scowling, right? Like think about what you do. What do you do when you're angry? You know, sometimes you might laugh in the face of anger. Sometimes you might cry. Sometimes you might sit silently and plot the demise of your enemy. You know, like there are many things you do in anger.
I do a lot of plotting.
And also people scowl for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with anger. They scowl when they are concentrating really hard. They scowl when somebody tells them a bad joke. They scowl when they have gas, you know? So the point is that there's no single marker, physical marker, for any emotion. And yet we experience anger and sadness and fear and other emotions that we seem to have no difficulty distinguishing. So that's a real puzzle. You know, like how is it that we have these experiences and we look at each other and we make inferences about, you know, in a snap, you know, like in the blink of an eye, we make inferences about each other's emotions, but yet there are no concrete, you know, observable markers of these emotions. To me, this seemed like I labeled this the emotion paradox, and it seemed to me to be a pretty interesting puzzle to try to solve. And I spent the next, you know, 15, 20 years of my career trying to solve that puzzle.
Oh, it's so fucking fascinating, Doc. It's so interesting because we all grow up consciously or not, intentionally or not, being programmed to believe that certain facial expressions absolutely correlate strongly with certain emotions or feelings or whatever, or states, you know, and when that figure there, that scowling only correlates with anger 30% of the time, which is, so the most of the time it doesn't, you know, that is so interesting because it's a complete, and I know this is not new for you, but new for me and my audience, it's a total paradigm shift on traditional and conventional thinking around this. Like even as you were talking, I was thinking there must be, I don't know if you've followed these or know these, but if you do know them, they would definitely shit you. That's an Australian word for annoy you. So there was, what's that show? There used to be a show on TV called Lie to Me. Which was the character was Cal Lightman, and it was based on the research of Paul Ekman, who did all that facial recognition stuff.
Do you know about that?
Right. And then the other one that springs to mind, so let's talk about this. So let me just, I'll clumsily explain that to my audience and then you fix up what I fuck up, right? So basically this dude called Paul Ekman developed software, I think it was, to interpret micro expressions and all of these things. So they could look at somebody's face and go, right, they're feeling this. This is what's happening on an emotional and or psychological level, blah, blah, blah. The other one that comes to mind is that show Bull. That's, I think, produced by Dr. Phil, where the star in the show, whose name is Jason Bull, has this ability to read people based purely on their physiology. Well, your research kind of, you know, at the very least contends that, doesn't it? At the least, if not refutes
it. I would say it refutes it. And it's not just my research. I mean, some of what we've done is really tabulated hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of experiments, right? And statistically summarized them to show that there are, you know, in a given instant, what you do in anger or sadness or fear, what your body is doing, even what's happening in your brain, let's say in anger, isn't necessarily fixed, and it won't necessarily predict what you will do and what your body will look like and what your face will do in another instance of anger. And the really interesting thing here is that this has been known for probably more than a century. So the great William James, who is, you know, considered to be one of the founders of American psychology, and, you know, wrote about emotion 150 years ago, that there were no essences, no physical essences for anger or sadness or fear, that every feeling of anger, which feels different to you, sometimes anger feels pleasant, sometimes it feels unpleasant, sometimes you're really worked up, sometimes you're cool as a cucumber, but angry, right? So all these different kind of varieties of anger, each one of them has its their own bodily state. And that was James's view. And what's so interesting about it to me is that that when you read introductory psych textbooks, like that, you know, and you would take in your first university course, they, many of them actually claim that James said the exact opposite of what he said. So they cite him as saying that, you know, there's one bodily pattern for anger, one for fear, one for sadness. And I'm thinking, how the hell did that happen? Like, this is one of the most respected, well-known psychologists, really somebody who's considered to be like a founding father, really, of psychology, modern psychology. And he's being cited in introductory psychology texts as saying the exact opposite of what he actually wrote. How did that happen? To me, that just seemed really interesting, and trying to get to the bottom of that mystery, you know, which is what I wrote about. And there are huge cultural differences in how people express emotion, and even in what they do in emotion, right? So for us, the stereotypic thing that you're supposed to do in fear is kind of like widen your eyes and gasp and, you know, freeze maybe, or run away. In Bali, the stereotypic thing to do in fear is to fall asleep.
Wow.
And the face, the stereotypic facial expression that's supposed to be universal, this wide-eyed gasping face in fear, is actually, in other cultures, it's considered a threat face or an anger face. Like when you're threatening someone, like Maori, the Maori war face has a lot in common with this, you know, supposed universal expression for fear. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, Paul Ekman's work for its time was really controversial and daring. I mean, it's ironic that even though he and I came to very, very different conclusions, you know, he was seen as kind of a maverick in his day. And he trotted off to, you know, Papua New Guinea and, tested people living in remote circumstances. And, you know, we did the same thing. We went to Africa, to a number of different communities in Africa. And we studied the Hadza in Tanzania and the Himba in Namibia, Northwest Namibia, and so on. And there are many, many, many studies now, you know, examining emotional life in remote cultures. And the majority of those studies make it really clear that variability is the norm. You know, variation is the norm when it comes to human emotion. And that's important to understand. It's important to understand how we misunderstood that so profoundly. And also, why does it matter? Like, why does it matter that, you know, that variation, that there's so much variation in human emotional states? And that's really what I've studied for a long time.
And it seems that's fascinating. And when you think about it, like in terms of just individual variability from human to human, it's like everything, our physiology responds differently, individual physiology responds differently to the same stimulus or the same food or the same, you know, whatever amount of sleep or, and so to think that every single person's physiology would express itself the same way to an emotion. Okay. So everybody's face does this when they're sad or happy or, but then even taking that further, Doc, like I think when we talk about, because the human experience is subjective and self-reporting and self-assessment is itself kind of fraught with complexity because, you know, what is hard for what I say is hard, Tiff will say is easy, and you'll say is moderate, or what I say is terrifying, someone else will say is exciting, someone else will say is boring. So we have all these arbitrary terms like anger or joy or happiness or sadness, which actually mean different things to different people. So we're not even, we're using the same word, but we're not talking about the same thing. And so,
yeah, so I think that actually even the word means something different to you at different points in time. So, you know, how your body responds to any food or drink or what have you in any given moment, it depends on the prior state that your body is in. So even you don't, even your own physiology doesn't respond in exactly the same way every single time. But, you know, here's what I would say, Greg. When I say a word to you, like if I say, Craig, I'm having pizza for dinner. I'm not actually having pizza for dinner, but if I were, I would say, Craig, I'm having pizza for dinner. That word, pizza, is a really efficient summary of a bunch of features that describe the food that I'm about to eat. You know, it's bready and it's a crust and maybe there's tomato sauce on it and it's got some cheese and maybe some other goodies on it. I don't have to describe to you, I don't have to take 15 minutes and describe to you every single feature. I can just say the word pizza. And with that word, that single word, I can basically do a kind of mental telepathy with you where I have in my head, you know, in my brain, I'm conjuring a bunch of features. I say a single word and that conjures a set of features in your head. Now, if you're from Chicago, where they have deep dish pizza, what's called deep dish pizza, and I said, I'm having pizza, you would, you're in your mind, you would conjure, you know, deep dish pizza, which would be a profound mistake because in my opinion, that's not actually even real pizza. I'm sorry. I love Chicago. It's a great city, but pizza crust should be thin. And I just, I feel really, really strongly about that. Okay. But that was a joke for your listeners. That was a
They definitely don't get humor. They definitely don't get humor. So I'm glad
You know what? It's just, I'm the least funny person in my house. So I sometimes have to say to my family, like, no, that was, I was, that I'm attempting to have a, make a joke there. Like, no, they're really funny. I'm just like,
see, that's the problem. When you're brilliant, when stuff comes out of your mouth and now you go, no,
really? She's so.
Yeah, I'm just, go with me. I'm just being a dickhead. They're like, no, mum, that is not you.
Yeah. or it's like, she's really pompous. She thinks she knows everything. She, you know, she studies emotions. So she thinks she knows, like she's proclaiming what is actually pizza. Anyways, my point being that, you know, you might get one or two of the features wrong, right? But generally speaking, it's still good enough to have efficient communication. And that's how language works. That's why language is so useful to us. It's also where language really fucks us up because when there's a lot of latitude to the features that you can imagine, that you can conjure automatically, even, you know, you don't even have to hear the whole word. I mean, the way the brain works, it works predictively. So your brain is already predicting every single word that comes out of my
mouth.
And, you know, imagine if I had said some other orifice of my body, that would be pretty surprising, right? And the point is that it's because your brain is always predicting. So your brain's kind of conjuring these, predicting what words will be spoken and conjuring these features even before they're out of my mouth and vice versa. And this is the way that we very, very efficiently communicate information to each other. But it's also the way that we can screw up communication, you know, if we're not careful.
Well, we're always making assumptions, aren't we? And guessing about how people are going to, you know, like I always say to people, your intention is not probably not someone else's experience, not necessarily someone else's experience. And like the only person who lives in my thinking is me. And I think because from when we were born until now, everyone listening to this right now and us three, like want it or not, we've been educated and programmed and trained. And so we sit here thinking that our version of reality is reality. Well, rather than, no, this is just my subjective understanding of what's going on. And trying to have an awareness bigger than our own or an understanding of a reality bigger than mine. so that I can open the door on a greater awareness and consciousness of someone else's experience in real time. Like that's an, I'm doing my PhD at the moment. I'm the world's oldest PhD student. Don't laugh. I didn't even want to tell you because I'm intimidated by you and I don't want you to ask me anything because I won't be able to answer it. But
I'm really, really curious to know what you're doing your PhD in.
I don't want to tell you because you're too clever, right? Plasticine, sandpit, monkey bars, right? So I majored in sandpit. And so I'm doing it in, all right, you will actually like what I'm doing it in. So I'm doing it in neuropsych, but I'm doing it on a thing called external self-awareness, which is your ability to understand how others perceive and process you. Mm-hmm. And so that is, in other words, what is the Lisa experience like for other people and your ability to be able to accurately represent that and your ability to be able to know in simple terms, not that I need to make it for you, but what it's like being around me. So my background, apart from all the other stuff I've done, is a lot of corporate speaking for years. So I used to say talking to fat blokes in suits, but you can't say that anymore, right? But talking to corporates, men and women, of all shapes and sizes and all, you know, all gorgeous humans, right? But talking about, you know, all the stuff, high performance and all of that normal corporate bullshit. But one of my observations was I would often work with CEOs or leaders who had no awareness what it was like being around them. And they thought they were a bit inspiring and funny, but the general consensus was either they were dickheads or they were intimidating or they were deluded, you know, or something in that space. And so trying to understand the gap between their representation and how others actually saw them. So for me, that was the catalyst for my question, for my research. And so I've developed a scale, which is in the middle of, I'm kind of validating at the moment, called Yes 40, which is the You Experience scale. So don't ask me anything hard though, but that's what I'm doing.
Well, I was going to ask you, when I remember a concept called objective self-awareness, and this comes from, I believe, symbolic interactionism, objective self-awareness is sort of like, sounds similar to, well, maybe not though, because it's not really about your stimulus value for other people, how other people experience you. It's, how other people observe you from the outside. So it's really more like, how are you, what kind of an object are you to other people? It's not really so much what's your impact? You know, like what's your impact on other people?
And so, it's funny, when I mention this to people in some circumstances, they get really self-conscious and self-aware and I have to say, no, this is not from a place of self-loathing, but rather just awareness of self and awareness, you know, of self for others. And, you know, realizing that I might be saying something to somebody and my intention is to empower or encourage or support, but literally what they are getting is judgment and criticism and unwanted feedback, despite my great intentions. And it's really just bringing that to people's awareness so that we can move forward from that.
But that's very sophisticated thinking that a lot of people have trouble with. So even, you know, like you were talking about these television shows, this idea that we read emotions or thoughts or any kind of internal state, that we read in people's faces or in their body language, you know, body movements are not a language to be read. The face is not, you know, like you can't read a face like you read words on a page. You're just inferring. Your brain is automatically and effortlessly making inferences, guesses, doing it, you know, preemptively, automatically, continuously. And no matter how confident you feel about the validity of your guess, of how true your guess is, it's just a guess and you can be wrong.
100%.
And, I think any kind of communication, like this is something I'm constantly trying to teach my students, that when you write, for example, it doesn't matter whether you're writing for a scientific audience or you're writing for a you know, popular audience, that you have to have a theory of mind for your audience members. You have to understand pace them before you leave them. You've got to meet them where they are, and you know, with language that they understand and concepts that they understand. And then if you want to move them forward or move them in a particular direction to think in a particular way, that's okay, but you have to meet them where they are first. And I think that one thing I've realized is that's not really a problem in writing. It's a problem in thinking, meaning when you communicate. Sounds like that's what you are teaching your clients. But there's this extra piece that you're talking about, which I think is really interesting. And that is not just understanding where they are, whoever you're talking to, but also what your signal value is for them, what your stimulus value is for them. And that's a pretty sophisticated thing to do, actually. I mean,
when I first started 100 years ago, Doc, when I set up the first personal training centers in Australia and was involved in writing the first accreditation for personal trainers in this country. And so I used to teach in a lot of courses. And one of the first, you know, there are evaluation sheets, and most of the evaluation about the students' experience with me was somewhere between okay and quite positive. But there was this one consistent negative, and that was not with everyone, but it was probably 2 or 3 out of 10. So maybe 20-25% of students would say, you know, Craig, good, enjoyed it, great content, bit funny, but a bit intimidating. And I'm like, and I've never in my life felt intimidating and never tried to intimidate anyone. But it was like it wasn't like it was one person. It was like, you know, six in a class. I'm like, what? So for me, I had to really go step back and go, what do I do? What is the Craig experience like for people? What am I doing or saying, or how am I being that is creating for some people this outcome? And that was like, that was 30 years ago. Or 25 years ago.
Well,
so
you were lucky. You were lucky that those people gave you that feedback, and you were very, very smart to pay attention to that feedback. I mean, imagine getting that feedback though. How do you get that feedback when you're a young woman of small stature and you're sort of challenging, you know, all of these, you know, ideas that have been around for a really long time? People find you intimidating, and as a woman, they hate you for it. So, you know, I mean, you have to go through a stage as a woman, I think, of any, you know, I'm not singing a poor me song. I just think that any woman who's a leader has to go through a stage of being seen as a bitch first, you know, and it's because, you know, you're violating, in order to do your job, you're violating your gender role, basically. And I got feedback like that too, but it was a little more harsh. And at the time I really didn't like the feedback, but after I got over, you know, feeling salty about it, I really thought about it. And this is the feedback I got. I got the feedback that went something like this. You know, you don't realize how intimidating you are. You know, when Superman pet a dog, he didn't know how strong he was, and he broke their neck. He broke the dog's neck. And
what?
I thought,
what?
Yeah. And I was like,
who wrote that?
Yeah. And so I was like, so at first I was just, oh, this is gender bias. What are you talking about? You know, I'm not that harsh. I'm just doing my job. And then, but then I thought about it. And after I got over being really upset, and I thought, well, actually, it's kind of what you're saying, right? Which is that, well, I was young. And I mean, I know I'm young now, but I mean, I was practically the age of my graduate students when I started as a professor. Mm. And I look young, or at least I did then. And I'm small. I'm not really tall. And I'm a woman in a field of mostly men at the time. And I'm being really critical of everything they're doing. So sure, I could actually see how that could feel, to a student, you know, really intimidating and actually unfair. And what it really did teach me something about the way that I present myself, that I have to be more mindful of that. And that's really true, I think, of any leader, which is, you know this because you taught this to people, but for me, it took me, no one taught me how to be a professor. Nobody taught me how to talk to the public. Nobody taught me these things. I just had to sort of figure it out as I went along. And sometimes, you know, when you do that, it's the school of hard knocks. You just have to figure out by fucking up and then, diagnose what you did wrong and then trying to correct it. And I'm not saying I'm always successful at that, but I think I have fewer students now who start off with me being afraid of what I'm going to say. You know, I'm sure there's still some of that there, but you can't learn from someone that you're afraid of.
But also I think, I mean, I was being a bit silly, a bit tongue in cheek, but the more I did a dive on you and I read your stuff and all your awards and all your, and then I watched you and I went, you know, I mean, really the overwhelming kind of feeling was respect, not terror, although there was 5% terror. But it's not because I'd met you or it's not because you'd done anything. It's just because I'm overwhelmed. I've always felt insecure and inadequate my whole life. And I've spoken about that a lot. And then when I go, I'm excited to talk to you, but also there's part of me that goes, I hope she doesn't ask me anything I can't answer.
But I think it might really surprise you to know that I probably spent my whole life insecure and also, so. I'm sorry, but yeah, sure. Because, you know, I mean, there's the whole imposter thing, which, you know, is definitely as a woman in science and so on. And also I grew up in a very impoverished way. So I come from a working poor family. I'm the first person in my, even in my extended family to go to university. And so like, I'm the first person to go to university of all my cousins and some of, and so, you know, and I end up being a professor and half the people in my family don't really understand what I do for a living. So yeah, of course. And also as a scientist, you're always trying to figure out how you're wrong about stuff. People are always really happy to tell you every little thing that you do that's a, you know, every study you run has a problem and everything you write has an, you know, somebody can disagree with. So I think that a healthy skepticism for your own, you know, views is held lightly, but still a healthy skepticism is not a bad thing, actually. You know what, if somebody asks you something you don't know, you know what to say. You just say, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know.
I'll get back to you. I don't know.
I think also with and I call myself a pracademic, not so much, even though I'm in an academic journey right now, but because a lot of people, you know, what they do or what they believe, you know, be it their religion or be it their credibility in the science world or the business world or the performing world, or it's like what I know and what I believe and what I do becomes my identity. So when you question what I think or you question my paradigm or you question my message or you then you question me, and by the way, I can't be wrong because that thing that I believe, that is who I am. And if you take that away, I'm fucked. So now I'm going to argue with you and hate you. You know, so there's this, like our sense of identity for a lot of us is an external, like an outside-in job where we get our sense of self from all of that external stuff. And then when somebody can, you know, confront that or refute that, then terror ensues.
I think you've said it beautifully. I mean, what you've just summed up really is a very Buddhist contemplative approach to identity. So this is something that I wrote about in How Emotions Are Made, my first book. And I think you're absolutely right. But I also think it's possible to cultivate an identity of a person as a person. First of all, you don't have one identity. You have many identities, right? You don't have one self. You have many selves. The features that define who you are really dependent on the situation that you're in. So right now you and I are chatting. And so I'm a scientist, but I'm also a mother and I'm a friend and I'm a gardener and I'm, you know, I'm many things. And that's important. It's important to be many things because to have many features to define who you are. because, you know, then you don't come to grasp at any of them too particularly strongly. But I would also say you can cultivate an identity as a person who is curious and who just doesn't know, or a person who, you know, like after I had my daughter, I watched all these women in my neighborhood and some of my colleagues, they had to choose, right? Are they going to work, continue working and put their kids in daycare or get a nanny, or are they going to stay home with their kids and give up their job? And I watched all these women kind of comport themselves like in a Procrustean way, kind of force themselves into one role or the other. And I thought, you know what? I'm just really ambivalent. Because when I'm home with my daughter, I want to be working, and there's a part of me that wants to be at work. And when I'm at work, there's a part of me that wants to be home with her. And you could just say, well, I'm perennially dissatisfied and unhappy person. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But I think for me, the honest truth was that I would really like to clone myself and be in two places at once. And that was the truth. So ambivalence was the actual authentic truth. And then it was just a more comfortable place to be, because then I didn't have to argue with anybody. I was like, yes. Yeah, I can see both sides, you know? And so I think that maybe we would all be better off if we just included an aspect of our identities where it was like, you can just admit that you don't, there are some things you just don't know, and that you might never know, or that you can be wrong and it's okay, or that people can be different from you in really profound ways. And even if you can't agree with what they believe, you can certainly agree that there's, in principle, it's okay for people to have different views, and that actually might be really useful at times. You know, it's really useful. Some of my closest academic colleagues are people who don't agree with me, and but who trust my intentions well enough that we can argue with each other as a way of trying to poke holes in our own logic, you know? Mm. And so I think that could be modeled more to people, that you don't, when someone challenges your identity, maybe that's an opportunity for you. It's a window instead of a, you know.
I agree. And I think also, you know, I don't know if this is more a male thing than a female thing. I feel like it might be a little bit, but it's probably a human thing. But I think like a lot of men feel like they have to be right. So there's this need to be right. And it's a burden. It's a, like an unnecessary self-created burden, emotional, psychological burden. And I go all the time. I mean, I get asked a lot of questions and, you know, some I'm pretty sure I know the answer. Some I have an idea. Some I've got no clue. I say I don't know all the time. But, you know, I think that one of the challenges is humans like certainty, predictability, familiarity, comfort. And on a level, life is none of that. You know, at some stage, the human experience is uncertain, at times unfamiliar, uncomfortable, unpredictable, you know, ergo COVID-19, right? But in the middle of all of that, we like certainty, and it just doesn't work. So the moment that we go, I'm okay with mess, I'm okay with chaos, I'm okay with not knowing, I'm okay with being wrong, I'm okay with fucking up, as long as I apologize, I feel like life's a lot easier.
I agree with you. And, you know, that's a really Buddhist, again, that's a very Buddhist approach, right? It's a very contemplative approach to life, to approach things with humility, to say, to not grasp at certainty. I mean, there are a number of reasons why certainty is so desirable and uncertainty or ambiguity is unpleasant. One of which is it's more metabolically costly. I mean, the two most expensive things your brain can do is move your body and learn something new. Mm. So when you're in a situation where something is uncertain or ambiguous, it's just more actually metabolically expensive. And if you're already running a body budget deficit. Like, you know, your brain runs a budget for your body. It doesn't budget money. It budgets salt and water and oxygen. It's, you know, trying to keep all the accounts solvent and get resources where they need to be before they're needed. That's a big job. And sometimes we, you know, run a deficit in that body budget, especially in modern life. There are all, you know, if I had to build an environment that really drained people's body budgets, it would be the one that we live in. You don't sleep enough, you don't exercise, you don't eat healthfully. I mean, like, I know I sound like a nagging mother, and I, you know, if you talk to my daughter, she would tell you I am a nagging mother, but here I'm just being a neuroscientist. And, you know, the uncertainty on social, you know, talking with people, interacting with them on social platforms is full of ambiguity. So I could go on and on and on. But and then, you know, then you add, you know, economic uncertainty and, you know, a crazy president, and which you don't have, but we certainly did. And then COVID on top of that. And, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about Trump. I'm just saying that for me, that was who the crazy president was. But for other people, it was Obama. And, you know, but everybody has something that is, you know, really what you would call stressful. And stress is just your brain preparing your body for a big metabolic outlay. I mean, exercise is stressful too. It's just that you can recover from it and replenish what you've spent. And so ambiguity and uncertainty that comes from human differences is really difficult for people to deal with when they're already running a deficit in their body budget, you know, when they're already feeling encumbered. They don't experience it that way, but that's one part of what's going on here, I think, in terms of, like, you know, increased intolerance and kind of wanting to surround yourself in an echo chamber of people who are like you.
Oh, the good old confirmation bias highway. Hey, now I know I've spoken too long. I just realized I'm being very cheeky because we've taken extra time. Here's a random question. Have you heard the term resting bitch face?
I certainly have.
That's got to be your next book, Doc, because that's trust me from a commercial and a marketing and a branding point of view, you've got to call you. Well, I shouldn't have said it on the podcast, should I? Because some
really people go and register. Well, you know what? There's also a word for this face looks like it's asking for a punch in German. It's like a great, it's very, very similar. But
well,
I like that.
I think that's a good name for a book. Well, because people used to say to me sometimes, because when I'm thinking, when I'm concentrating or focusing, apparently I have a resting bitch face. And people go,
no, but yeah, but you know what? We've structurally analyzed resting bitch faces, and they're just structurally at rest faces. That there's really nothing. It's all in the inference. And
all right, so all you fucking haters who tell me about my resting bitch face, I'm just like a leading world authority. I'm not a bitch, all right? I'm just fucking deep in thought. Hey, Doc, we really appreciate you. What do you want to promote and pump, and where do you want to steal people? I know you have a website. I know you have, is your most recent book How Emotions Are Made, or is there one in the pipeline?
There's a book that was recently published. It's called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain.
Oh yeah.
It's a book of little essays about the brain. You know, it's kind of, it's attempts to be funny in certain places. It communicates some really fun, interesting tidbits about neuroscience that you can, you know, use to entertain your friends. And it invites you in these little essays to think about really big topics. Like, you know, human nature and what kind of human you want to be. So it's my husband calls it the first neuroscience beach read.
Well, I do remember, sorry, that slipped my mind, but I do. And I think it's like, I think you said somewhere, it's like, it's a neuroscience book for like general consumption, which is nice.
Yes, yes, so. It is. And in fact, they're really little bite-sized essays. So you can read them in, you know, under each one can be read in while you're having a bath or when you're eating breakfast or, you know, on a subway, you know, from one subway stop to another. I mean, they're really pretty short, but they were written to linger, meaning that you think about them well beyond, you know, the time when you read them. That was the design anyways. And at least what I've heard from, at this point, probably now thousands of readers, is that that at least it was successful on that point. So
7.5 lessons about the brain. All right, everybody, go and get buy 10 copies and give them to people for Christmas, because it's going to be here before we know. Just 10, no pressure. What's your website? What's your web address?
LisaFeldmanBarrett.com, all one word.
Perfect. If you can stay there so we can say goodbye after we sign off, but thank you for being on the U Project. We greatly appreciate you.
It was my absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Tiff.
Thank you. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, everybody. Love you guts.